Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I...
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Gottfried Straight, No Chaser. Well, we are back on the boards again. This is, oh my goodness, I don't know, episode 112, I guess, something like that. I stopped counting now. And I thank you all for really making it possible for this this whole wonderful experience to be lasting this long. Who knew when I started Lenny Gottfried Straight, No Chaser, just taking a little whim that I could do something during the pandemic, that I would be able to continue it this long with such wonderful guests. And speaking of that, wait until you hear who is coming on here this evening. Such a treat. And how we rehooked up with one another is another, okay, a whole nother story. But before we get into that, I want to be able to do a little bit of the housekeeping that I normally do, which makes it easier for those people who are tuning in for the first time, for them to see where they are and how they can tune back in and see some of the past episodes or hear some of the past episodes that we've done over the years. Now, you are listening to blogtalkradio.com/ S is in Sam, F is in Fred, T is in Tom, H is in Harry, and the number 2. Why is that important? Well, if you just say blogtalkradio.com, you'll get to, but you'll get to a station where you have a lot of different programs that are being listed. The slash SFPH2 takes you directly to Lenny Gottfried Straight, No Chaser, where you have a selection of more than 100 episodes over the years that you can listen to. You can, you know, if you've heard it before and you want to hear it again, that's fine. You have your choice. And then this evening, if you want to join us in our conversation, and the board is beginning to fill up now, thank you all for coming in, you can dial in 516-453-6063. And I've been neglectful in thanking all the people all over the world who choose to tune in from time to time. Sometimes I think they hear the recording, because when you talk about people in China, it's a little difficult for me to believe that they're tuning in at the same time that we're doing this. But they show up on the statistics, and I thank our friends in California and in Canada and in Texas and, of course, New York, New Jersey, everywhere. You know, those of you who tune in and are so faithful, and every Wednesday at 7 p.m., you say this is your cocktail hour. Well, I'm going to try to make that true as long as I possibly can. Now, I will say this. February, which starts tomorrow, is Black History Month for the American culture, and it keeps us reminded of the contribution of the Black American culture to our American history. I will be doing several projects then, but I will be active on this program for the first Wednesday and the last Wednesday, 2 episodes, and I'm dedicating that to my teacher, my mentor, who was so influential in my career. His name was Lloyd Richards, and he directed, he was the first Black director on Broadway, and he directed A Raisin in the Sun. So we're going to talk to the people on the first episode who have made it possible for a street on Broadway to be named after him, and then hopefully one of his sons will join us the second episode at the end of the month. Now, gave you enough forecast for next month, let's talk about tonight. Well, my guest tonight, I said in my introduction on Facebook, I said, you know, we worked around one another. We would be in meetings. We would be planning some of the concerts that I was doing, but I never worked with the wonderful Diane Witcher. She is absolutely a magnificent, and I'm going to ask her about this, the word conductor. She's an award-winning conductor, an author, and a composer, and a conducting teacher. And you know how I feel about the arts and education and how important that is. She is currently the musical director and conductor of the Allentown Symphony Orchestra, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You hear me talk about Allentown Symphony all the time, how wonderful I was greeted and how I had the opportunity to play, I think, in every single room there that they have, and how wonderful the orchestra is, how wonderful the staffing is. I'm so glad to have someone again from the Allentown Symphony Hall here. Continue with Diane. I want to talk about, she's written two books, Beyond the Baton and Baton Basics, Communicating Music Through Gestures. Now, I have to tell you, if you've not experienced a black bag, I think it's a brown bagging with Diane, you have not experienced the explanation of a musical piece and how wonderful she makes it so comfortable for those of us like me who, though I have a classic background, I'm not really, really schooled in all of the classics and the journeys and the different parts of the music. Absolutely fabulous. And to think that she has written that and music through gestures, all the things that she does, I can't wait to talk to her about it. So we know that she's also a composer, and she's composed Mist and Ode to Joy Fanfare. So we're going to talk to her about that. I just want to say a couple of the awards that she's received, and then I'm going to ask Diane to say hello. She's received the Helen M. Thompson Award from the League of American Orchestration, the USC Thornton School of Music Outstanding Alumni Award, and was named nationally one of the top 30 professional musicians by Musical America Worldwide. Now, with all of that, and it took me 10 minutes just to introduce her, please welcome my dear friend who we experienced a snowstorm together, Diane Witchie. Diane, say hello.
Hello, everybody. It's great to be here. And Lenny, thanks for inviting me to be on the show. This could be great fun.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, we were always in the same building, but we're always doing different things. So we would pass each other, say hello, do, you know, talk for a few minutes, and then we'd go off. Well, but when we got cut, stuck on the bus with the snow, we had an opportunity to talk about all of the things I think that we have in common, our concern about the future of music and partnering it and making sure that all of the cultures are appreciated by cultural, by classical music. So I thank you so much for coming in, for saying yes and being a guest here and being able to share some of the thoughts that you have about where music is going. But before we go there, why don't you tell me, how did it all start? Where were you born? And how has music really changed your life with that? Talk about that.
Yeah, so I grew up in Southern California, in Pasadena, mm-hmm. and my mom was very into music, and she, I don't even think we probably had a choice, but we were, there were five of us, and we were all enrolled in violin lessons. My oldest brother actually, I think, got out of it, and he learned clarinet, but then the rest of the four of us learned violin, and so mm-hmm. violin was enabled me to, you know, we went to music camp in the summer. We played in the youth orchestra. We played in the school orchestra. And through music, as you say, it really gave us all a place to belong, a place to sort of to achieve, to have some friendly competition with our friends, but to also really open up our soul as a venue. And so then I went on to college. I actually attended USC in Southern California. And while I was in college, I was a violin major, but realized there were some really good violinists. You know, it's like, you know, you grow up and you're kind of a big fish in a small pond. I was, you know, concertmaster of the orchestra and won the concerto competition. And then you go to college and, you know, some of my friends and colleagues that I went to college with are, you know, professional musicians playing in the New York Philharmonic. And in fact, Cindy Phelps, who is the principal violist in the New York Philharmonic, is going to be playing with the Allentown Symphony in next week, actually. And we went to school together. So I realized that maybe I wanted to branch off a little bit. And that's when I discovered conducting. And conducting really combined all the things that I love about music. So I loved sort of being involved with more than just one part. So the violinist, you're in the middle of it. But I kind of, as a child, I always kind of liked to be in charge of things. And so conducting allows that sort of sense of responsibility and also that leadership. So then I've kind of never looked back after that. And luckily, I feel very blessed that I've been able to always make a living as a professional conductor.
Well, you know, that one of the questions I wanted to ask was, how does one become a conductor? Is it fate? Does conducting choose you, or the things that you do lead you there? And that you kind of answered that for me, because I being a music major, I took viola for a little bit, not long, and then I became a voice major. But
I didn't know you played viola. That is so great.
Yeah, for a little bit. I don't talk about it now because it's been too many years, you know. But the idea that music can take you where you need to go almost has been my journey. It has been. I went from taking piano to viola, but always voice was always there. It was always a studying there, but it was a way of understanding the voice even more, the intricacies of the different instruments underneath you as you vocally would interpret the music. So do you feel like, when you were playing the violin and at that, because I know you well enough to know that you were a fine violinist. But did that journey kind of take you toward the conducting with all of the other characteristics that you talk about? I mean, we do share that. I like being in charge too. That's why I like being the vocalist, because you know. Kind of determine the rhythm, you kind of determine how you're going and all of that. But did, you know, with all of that, wasn't the music though, didn't it have a strong, I guess, push on you going in that direction also, or am I off base with it and it was just me, I thought? What do you think about
that? No, I think you're absolutely right. So when I was growing up, I never thought about conducting. It never even occurred to me. I didn't, there were no role models, you know, there were no women conductors at that time period. So you couldn't just go to a concert. So, but I did a lot of teaching. So I started teaching violin when I was in junior high school. Some people babysat, I babysat too, but I found that I would teach all the neighborhood kids violin. And I liked the teaching. And then in high school, the director often would have paperwork to do, and he'd just say, oh, Diane, take the class today, you know. So I would actually work with the orchestra. But I wasn't really conducting so much. I was playing and coaching. But when I took my very first conducting class, it was required as a junior in college. And I remember it vividly because it was just like this explosion in my mind, where deep inside I knew that this is what I was supposed to do. And then it took me another 3 or 4 years to really make the commitment, because once again, there were no role models. It was a path that I hadn't ever thought about before. So even figuring out what it was to be a professional conductor. And what's interesting is when I started out, I think I had relatively low aspirations. I thought, well, if I could just get out and conduct, you know, at maybe a program, or, you know, and I actually started an orchestra when I was a junior in college, because in order to graduate and to apply for the master's program, you had to have a year of conducting experience. But who's going to hire you if you've never conducted anything? So I started my own kids orchestra in the summers to get some experience so that I could apply for the job. And then when I got into the master's program, it was one of the top programs in the country, and they only took 4 people a year. So that was really the deciding moment where I knew I wanted to do it, but I needed someone else to also believe in me. So that's an important thing for people in the arts is as much as you believe in yourself, you also need mentors and people that really will encourage you to be successful. And that's so important to have that sort of the wind behind you when times get tough.
I think also, you know, they have a vision. As we matured, you know, when you see someone who has potential, and they have that person who encouraged you has had that experience to know that you have those things that the potential to keep you the longevity. There are a lot of talented people there, but a talent is not the only thing. There's a discipline that one must have. There's that commitment that one must have. All of those are things that I don't think people figure in when they figure in a career choice or the choice of fame. And, you know, they see it as this thing and they think, well, I can do this one thing, whatever it is, whether it's acting, it's dancing, it's being a musician of some kind. But they don't understand the other components of it that allow you to get to that point. And those components are consistency. It's longevity. It's determination. It's actually being relentless in your pursuit of it. When you talk about being a junior and creating an orchestra, you say it and I created an orchestra. I don't think so, Ms. Singh. That is a great achievement. You know, it is, you know, doing what I do for a living, I have a great respect for other parts of the arts that I touch. And I think I recommend for everyone who is in the arts, especially when you determine what specifically you want to do, is that you try to find out every aspect of it. If you're in music, really try to find out all of those things, about as many instruments as you can, and what degree of discipline it took in order to learn that instrument. And that's why I have such a great respect for musicians, having been trained, for a long time taking lessons myself. I understand what they achieved on that instrument to be where they are, because I had to achieve it in my body using my instrument to be where I am. So I'm going to ask you, you mentioned that all of your siblings were all musical. How are they still musical, your siblings?
They're musical in their own way. So we grew up also playing instruments, but also we had a player piano, so we did a lot of singing around the player piano. We all sang in choruses. So my oldest brother married a professional musician, so I kind of laughed because he was the one that he was too cool, you know, and you know, he thought we were kind of nerds playing violin and viola and string instruments, but then he lands up marrying a professional cellist. My next brother, he sings still. He's not doing too much with music, but then another brother actually switched to viola, and he's now playing in a community orchestra, and he's a paid soloist at a church, so he does it more on the side. And then my younger sister landed up being a teacher, but she's working with an international baccalaureate program in an inner city school, and she does a huge amount of music outreach, and including, you know, she has a thing with little kids rock, where they, you know, teach the kids how to play pianos and little guitars, and And I remember she bought 135 ukuleles for her school because ukuleles are very small and easy for kids to learn on. They can press the strings down. But the funny thing that I sort of laughed with her is what she didn't realize is when she bought 135 ukuleles, she had to tune 135 ukuleles.
Amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you,
but yeah, so they are still musical.
Yes. Well, yes, they are. They are. Everyone has their level, their status that they achieved. Why Allentown? Because you have now conducted all over the world and all over the country. So why did you settle on being the musical director and conductor of the Allentown Symphony Orchestra?
Yeah, and that's a good question. So first off, they did a two-year national search when they were looking. So when I was appointed, I was working with an orchestra in Texas. And I think for about 5 years, I went back and forth between the two. But then I really knew I needed to be up on the East Coast. So then my husband and I, we relocated up here. And then I was doing Allentown and the Norwalk Symphony. And I was living outside of New York and going back and forth. But as the years went by, Allentown was the orchestra where there was such community commitment to becoming something really great. And so over the years, as I, you know, brought all sorts of different expansion ideas to the board and as I really pushed the orchestra artistically, I just got a really great satisfaction of making music in a community and the ability to change that community on many, many different levels through this music making. So not just the concerts, but also our El Sistema program, our symphony chorus, our expansion. You know, we're doing the jazz upstairs now, all of our outreach. We do a young musician string festival where, you know, people all over come up to me and said, oh, I played in the young musician string festival 10 years ago and have such great memories. And so I felt that this was a community that there was a lot of positive energy and the ability to really make a difference. And I always say my philosophy is always bloom where you're planted. And so I was planted here when they offered me the job, and then I bloomed it into what I envisioned was the type of orchestra I wanted to lead.
Well, you know, it's so very interesting. I mean, having been a part of it for a little while, especially when I first moved here, not thinking that I was going to do a lot of music anymore. I mean, I just thought, well, you know, I've had my time. I've done all of my things. And discovering the love of the arts that's in that building from the people, the dedication that's in that building, it really does.
It's multi-generational. We have people on the board that their parents were founding members of the orchestra. Yes. I mean, it's like unbelievable, you know? And I remember when there was a... Yeah, there was a time where we were having, you know, financial difficulty because we own a concert hall as well as having an orchestra. And all of the community leaders came together and helped raise $6 million, you know, so that we could really do the renovations to the hall that needed to be done and expand the orchestra. And that took such community pride.
It did.
You know, and so, yeah, for me, you know, yes, I could have just gone on and you know, done a concert with one orchestra and the next day be in another city with another orchestra and another orchestra and sort of do the guest conducting route. But I don't think for my personality I would have the same satisfaction because for me it's not just the music, it's the sharing of the music with the people and opening up people's eyes to things that they might not have realized that they would really enjoy. And that's what was made possible through the Allentown Symphony Organization.
So you fit so well because I spoke about it. I call it the black bag, the brown bag, brown bagging.
Right.
The fascination.
Yeah, we started that years ago. So people were supposed to bring their lunch, a brown bag. That's where it got the name. mm-hmm. and then just sit for an hour while we talk about the music, and we have the guest artists there, and often they'll play mm-hmm. something, and usually it's very mm-hmm. spontaneous, and people can ask questions, mm-hmm. and I play little musical excerpts and kind of clue them into what's going on. And so once again, it's breaking down barriers and opening up the experience for everyone. Where so often people feel like, you know, the people on the stage are separated from the people in the audience.
Yes. Yeah, there's such a physical separation that it lends itself to the, you know, to think that you're not approachable. But
right, exactly.
What I find, the brown bag is a wonderful feature that Symphony has. But I'm trying to describe enthusiasm, that's the word, about, you know, trying to explain the pieces to people so that they can see it, not, you know, it's not just, oh, it's a pretty piece of music, but understand what the composers were talking about, understand what the movements were, breaking it down without having to be a music major, because a lot of the people who were in those, you know, who attended, some of them enjoy music, but they weren't music majors. They're music enthusiasts.
Right.
But, you know, you don't make it seem like you have to go to a conservatory in order to understand the jargon that you're talking about. You actually make it very, very reasonable for those of us, and you know, and I do that for a living, but to enjoy the journey of the piece, to enjoy those movements and why they go from one to the other and what emphasis is. And that, I've been to a couple of them, and they're not like yours. You know, you do get a chance to hear the music. You do hear a lot of the musicians, some of them made themselves available for that. The guest artist is there, but it's not, it doesn't lend you to really examining the piece and falling in love with the music and the choice of why you chose the music. And that I think is what I admired about that makes yours different. And I encourage people, if they have the opportunity in the listening audience in the area that we're in, or even if you have to travel. But if you have an opportunity to, and if it's offered, and to experience it with Diane, you really should, because it is visual. You know, you're far more visual than you think you are. You know you're musical, but you're very visual. You use a lot of visual, like falling waters down a, you know, I remember you did something like that, and the music is like falling waters down a waterfall or something, you said. And I went like, oh, okay, I get it, because I could see, I could see folks doing that, you know. It's a wonderful journey that you create, so I give you kudos for that. I really have to say, I wanted to be able to, you know, to say that to you. I never got a chance to. I'd be there, and then we'd all split up and go, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep. Well, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Tell me about the reasons why you decided to both write the book and compose. What part of the career is that? What part of the journey, the musical journey is that, or the teaching journey is the writing of the books and the composing?
Mm-hmm. So it's two different stories. So the first book was the Beyond the Baton. And it's, you know, once again, sometimes I think things kind of just come to you, but I literally woke up and it was like February, I remember. And I remember thinking that a lot of young conductors were struggling and some were losing their jobs because they didn't know what their job was. They knew the job of the musical side and conducting the rehearsals, but they didn't really understand how to be an artistic leader in a community. And I just suddenly woke up one day, and I had struggled for a few years, and then luckily, you know, had an orchestra that kind of trained me instead of me training them. And I decided that someone had to write this book to help people know more about how to be a really good artistic leader. And I thought through my colleagues in the field and thought none of them are going to sit down and write this book. So I basically sat down and wrote this book. And I actually wrote it on the island of Elba in Italy because there was a grant I could apply for where if you had a project, you could go there for 3 weeks and work on that project. So I did I did a lot of work before I went there, but when I went there, I did sort of a brain dump, and I just, you know, typed up everything I had learned and studied, and, you know, I'd read a lot of management books, and I tried to apply, you know, management-type leadership to artistic leadership, and so that book really has become a standard not only nationally but also internationally. It's required reading in Australia. I was guest conducting in Bosnia. And I walked in my book, apparently they had bought it before they knew I was coming over there, but my book was sitting on the desk of the executive director. I was like, oh, that's my book, you know. And so many times I get emails from people around the world. I just got one from somebody in Brazil saying how much it helped them. So that's something that's very important to me is helping other people. So then the composing. This same retreat in Elba, I wanted to go back because it was so cool. I mean, you live in this villa, it's right on the water, and they have a vineyard, and you drink their wine, and they had this Busendorfer grand piano. So then I thought, well, I need another project. And I never composed ever anything, except for, you know, little tiny melodies, you know, in college. And I thought, well, you know, I began to be hearing music in my head, and I wasn't hearing other people writing the type of music that was in my head. And so I thought, well, I'll just apply to compose a piece, and then I can go and stay on this beautiful island for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks and, you know, have some, you know, quiet, reflective time. And I wrote my piece Mist, and when I came back, I thought, well, gee, I think this is pretty good. So I had sort of the chutzpah of just program it with the Allentown Symphony. And, you know, luckily the board went along with me and actually got covered by the Philadelphia papers because everybody was curious, you know, here's a conductor that's written her first orchestral piece and what is it going to be like? Mm-hmm. And then I think I had shared some of it with a colleague of mine at one of the music publishing companies. And then so immediately the vice president of Presser, which is a music publishing company, called and wanted to sign the piece. So I was pretty thrilled that, you know, as a composer, my very first piece was signed with a professional publisher. And so since then, I think I've written 7 or 8 pieces, not a huge number of pieces, but they are getting played actually throughout the world. My Ode to Joy fanfare we're doing in April with the Allentown Symphony, but it's been played in Germany and other countries and across the United States. And my After the Rain was played in Florida recently, and I think it's going to be played in the Seattle area. So it's really fun to also have that component. But part of the reason was I also was thinking of people like Bernstein, who had such a diverse life as a creative person. So he was not just, he was a pianist, he was a conductor, he was a composer, he did TV shows, he wrote, you know, music for musicals. And I just felt it would make me a better, well-rounded musician to force myself to expand.
The whole experience of writing on an island, the impetus is, you know, it makes me, I kind of think, well, maybe I missed out on something. Maybe I need to write my next book on an island here or something, you know.
Yeah. Well, they closed down the retreat. Otherwise, I'd give you the information because it was one of those kind of private retreats that was all word of mouth. They didn't have a website, but they closed it down. So it was great. But there are other places. There are other places you can apply to go and work on creative projects. In fact, there's a place in Connecticut called iPark, I-Park. And so for anyone listening, this is an interdisciplinary retreat where people apply from over the world, and it's writers, it's musicians, composers, it's performance artists, it's watercolor artists or videographers. And if you're accepted, then you go there for a month, and most of your food is provided, and you're given a studio. And it's great to go do a retreat where you can just not have the other worries of the world around you, and you can just really focus on being creative.
Well, you know, I don't know how that feels, being in a house with husband and dogs and everything. Everything kind of fits, you know, fits around their schedule. I kind of sneak the time in to be creative when, you know, when they're on the walks or, you know, off outside doing something, talking to everyone else. But I think it's one of the things that I like about the word retreat is that it does make you feel like you just leave everything at the door of the place that you're leaving. And you bring nothing with you but the artistry. And you get a chance to really focus on that with no distractions. And that's important. One of the things that we talked about on the bus was the partnering of cultures and the partnering in the arts that consistently has to go on with the cultures changing everything. What do you think about music, classical music now? There's so many components of it. Does it border on with fusion of some kind, or are we keeping very close to a classical linear kind of music? How do you think it's going now? Because I'm trying to figure it out. Some of it I can figure out, some of it I can't. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think everyone in the country is sort of trying to figure it out, and I think it's going to figure itself out for us. But what I've seen is, you know, I don't even really refer to the orchestra as classical music. I like to actually just say orchestral music, music that utilizes an orchestra. And so I really think that in the day when, say, Mozart was writing, or, you know, later people, it was the music of the time. It was the entertainment of the time. You know, the opera overtures that we play now were the Broadway shows of that era. And I think that sometimes we forget that, and we only look to the history and to the museum positioning of the orchestra. And I like to think more of, you know, what's current now is film music, a lot of different types of you know, jazz influences, folk influences in the orchestra. And I'm seeing that with a lot of the young composers, that they're not feeling straight-jacketed like there was an era where, you know, they would feel guilty if they had a beautiful melody. I mean, this is so ridiculous, because they felt they had to be intellectual and prove how smart they were moving these notes around in this very mathematical thing, and aren't I brilliant that I can do this? And to me, if music doesn't impact you in your soul, then it's not going to last. It might get a performance, and it might be impressive to someone that's smart enough to figure it out. But I love the pieces that really either make you want to dance, make you want to cry, make you want to smile, that influence you deeply. And that's the amazing thing about music. And I think people are feeling free now to write music more from the soul, and utilizing any sort of eclecticism within their music for orchestra. And perhaps we may begin to see the instrumentation of the orchestra shift. You know, John Adams, you know, started quite a few years ago now, maybe 40 years ago. He's a classical composer, but he started using synthesizers in the orchestra. And I think we're going to see more synthesizers. We just did a Duke Ellington show with the orchestra. And of course, you've got to have your combo, your drum set, your guitar player. They've got to be able to read chord charts. So you've got to have different skill sets. We had to have trumpet players, saxophone players that could read chord charts. Now, for somebody listening, a chord chart would be just the listing of the harmonic chords, as opposed to the notes being all written out. And that takes a different type of training, and so I think musicians are also being cross-trained in different types of styles. So I think we're going to see a lot of change, and it's going to be driven by young people out of school. There's a group called Time for Free, and they're actually doing a lot of this where they're commissioning a lot of pieces, but their pieces are definitely what we call crossover. There's a lot of rock influence, a lot of pop influence, a lot of jazz influence, and a lot of good orchestral writing, you know, writing well for orchestral instruments. But it's exciting.
Yes, it sounds it. I mean, I hadn't, you know, I mean, I am just one of those dinosaurs of the American songbook kind of persons, you know, and that traditional kind of a melodic music. But do you think that that will also change the traditional music that lends itself to jazz? I mean, today, again, I heard a piece today with, I think we talked earlier, with Sarah Vaughan and Sammy Davis, and it's a traditional piece. Tenderly was a standard piece, but of course, when those two get to it, who knows where they can go?
Yep.
I mean, the mood is even too close. Do you think that kind of treatment to a song that is traditional like that do you think that it's because it is so ingrained in our society, will that be something that has longevity, or will that change? You know, will that, or is it based on the stylists that do it?
Yeah, I think some of the songs will remain, just like some songs from, you know, the 1600s have remained.
Yes.
Pachelbel canon, you know, but not all the songs are going to remain. I think, you know, pop tunes, like when I was in high school and college, you hear them on the radio now. They're becoming now classic tunes.
Yes.
And the best of the best, the ones that resonate, will stay, and the ones that don't resonate are going to fall by the wayside. But not to say that they might not be rediscovered, because, you know, Bach had basically fallen by the wayside totally, and then Mendelssohn rediscovered Bach and brought back and started performing his pieces, and that took over again. So there will be definitely cycles of music.
Okay.
But the young people today, you know, we think of, Even with movies, you know, think of Star Wars. How many years ago there are kids that are growing up now that have never seen Star Wars. And
yeah,
so therefore they don't know that music. Cartoons, you know, the classical music that was used in cartoons when I was growing up and before I was growing up, you know, the young people now, they don't know that music, but they know video games. So we may see a morphing of themes from video games suddenly becoming themes that composers use to write a symphony or to write a piece for orchestra, because that's what people know. So I think we have to be a little bit open to new ideas.
Yeah.
That the cream always rises to the top. You know, the best will hopefully get performances and will resonate.
I think now that you say that, it's like a reinvention of things, you know, everything old becomes new again.
Of those standards, people rewrite them. They change sort of the harmonies, add some more, change the tempo, put a little different feel, you know, but if it's a good melody, it will probably survive, but not all of them will survive. And that's the sadness, is that there's a lot that won't survive.
And then sometimes those that don't become popular, somebody pulls them out of a trunk and then revives them in a different way, and they're one of the specialties. But now I want to get you. What is it that you, now we're down, you know, we only have about 10 more minutes, so see how fast this goes. What do you want to do next? What does Diane see for the next 5 years?
You know, that's a very interesting question, because COVID sort of changed everything a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think it made all of us reflect a little bit more on what's important, you know, particularly if you know people that passed away during COVID, that you really started to think differently. So I think part of my goals going forward, and I have to find time, is I want to do a workbook for my conducting, my Baton Basics book, which is my second book, is a technique book for conductors, and a lot of people are telling me nationally that they'd love to have a workbook. So one of my goals is to make the best conducting workbook in the country and that it will be utilized by all the schools. And it's not so much that I want my name out there as writing the best conducting book, but I teach so many conductors that have started out all wrong and have all the wrong habits. It would be like you teaching a vocalist that had just started totally with the wrong habits, and then you have to start all over. So if my books were able to have everybody start out better and really understand how their body works for the gestures, I would feel like I did the whole field a major service. So that's one goal. And then during COVID, I started working on some repertoire books that would help people kind of know where all the hard spots were in all the pieces. So once again, you know, if you've never conducted the piece, you read these four or five pages and it kind of helps you be more successful your first time through a piece. So that's on sort of the writing side. And then on the composing side, I just want to compose more because, you know, a concert is great and I love, love, love conducting concerts and I love the interaction with the audience and with the musicians, but you conduct it and it's gone. And there's something really special about writing a piece of music and then people 100 years or 200 years from now can play my music and maybe feel a little bit of my soul. And it's weird because when I write music, I honestly don't know where it comes from. I just try to be very organic and write what comes through my head without judgment. And I find when I do put judgment and I try to fix it, it usually gets all sort of stifled. But when I just let it flow out of my brain onto the page, then afterwards I listen to the piece and I went, where did that come from? I don't even know. And I listen to it sort of separate to see it out there as a total different entity. And then I want to do more types of conducting of concerts that encourage people of diverse backgrounds and not even like so much ethnic backgrounds, but people maybe it's economic backgrounds where people maybe have thought, oh, symphony music is not for me. I want to do concerts that they come and it's fun and they get it and they're touched and they're excited and they're moved. So concerts that are a little bit more informal, maybe even in a different type of space, so that people can feel the impact of the music. So it's sort of a three-pronged approach of goals going forward, but hard to do it, as you know, because I've got a major orchestra that I'm working with all the time and have to work all those concerts in too, but have to find the time.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, what's life without the dreams, you know, and for you to move forward? And, you know, just thinking about it, you talked about when you were younger, there were no role models. It's, you know, you're so involved in it. And there are, I mean, I think there are groups that advocate for women conductors now. And I think you're interested in all of those kinds of things. But when you think about a time when it was impossible to think about these positions that a lot of us hold, that women weren't even, it wasn't even an aspiration, you know, you didn't even think about it at all, and where we are now and how we're trying to explore that and move forward with that. And it has to do with who we are, but little to do with our own personal ego and more to do with moving forward a whole movement to make sure that those opportunities are there for people to enjoy the arts. And that's one of the things that that's why I keep doing this particular program, because I don't think we understand the impact of the arts on our lives. enough. If we look around in a room and you take all the artwork out of the room, you then will begin to understand the impact that art has for us, because if we took all the art off, we'd have, you know, we would be down to plywood, really.
Yeah,
it's just paint.
Well,
you know,
and the arts, yeah, it impacts in so many ways. So even,
so
you know,
many.
The arts and the creativity, but also even the economic impact of the arts, people don't realize. You know, if there was no Broadway in New York, my goodness, the economy of New York would, like, fall because the tourists wouldn't go there as much anymore if there were no art museums and Broadway shows and the Philharmonic and the opera, you know?
All of those things are, they're pulling, that's why they're pushing it so hard, because it is an integral part of our tourism economic base in New York City. I mean, yes.
And they saw that with COVID, when nobody could go to anything, you know?
When nobody could go.
Tourism crashed no matter what during COVID, but...
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Without the arts. Yeah.
Without the arts, there was no color. You know, it was a flat it was flat base during the pandemic. You know, the economy, New York still functioned. I mean, it is the focus of the economic headquarters of the world, but what well-rounds it is all of the other things that are offered in New York. And yes, it's offered in the Asian world. Yes, it's offered in London. Yes, but there's something very special about it when it comes here, when people come here and all of the things that we borrowed from a lot of the European countries and put in our culture. But when you think about what our world would be without the introduction of radio or television, live performances and what it does, how it's healing, all of those things. Those are the things that I think about what would keep driving me to do this, because you realize that people have to digest the fact that the arts really have to be a priority in our lives. And they're not at this point. You know, they we still have to fight so very hard just to get programs. Small programs, you know, for our children, for the communities, like you say, that are economically based, not necessarily racially based, but economically based, to appreciate all the different facets. We still have to keep on pushing it and be relentless about it, because without it, it's a different kind of world, the world that we would have, you know. It's a different kind of world. So,
well, and the arts also, they teach such creative thinking, and even in, you know, the sciences, even in math, you've got to have creative thinking, or we're, as a society, we're not going to move forward, you know?
Yes, agreed. It's just one of those things where, you know, I would not want to do anything else for a living. It's not that, I could, but I wouldn't want to.
Right, you choose not to.
Yes, I choose not to. It's such a wonderful, I think, opportunity to be in this business. And I tell people how blessed they are to be doing this, to be doing something that you love and that can impact people. There are many jobs that impact people's lives, and we're grateful for all of those jobs that people do every single day. But I'm also very grateful for the impact that the arts has, on this society, because it's borderless. It just goes on and on and on and on, different kinds of ways that you find it. So I will always be there, whether it's on this program or just, you know, as we talk about doing things, always want the arts to move forward. You know, that's just, and, you know, this period of time that we've been here, where we've lost a lot of the great icons, and just losing two just yesterday with Hinton Battle and Cheetah Rivera, it's just, you know, you want to hold on to the contribution that these great people have made in our in the performing arts, in the records of it, and showing the showmanship that they have. They were just they were the real thing. They were the real thing, and how blessed it is to have been in a circle where you could touch them for a little while. But
yeah,
now I neglected to do one thing more than anything else, and that was to make sure that the phone, one of my phones would not work and would not ring. I forgot that. That's the one thing that I forgot to do in this recording. But now we're down to the last couple of minutes, so I'm going to invite those people who have been here quietly listening to us here in the studio will to come to the webinar, because we're going to take a little break and for a second or two and move from just the audio to the video and just talk for a minute or two about music and just a little bit more about what our place is, what power we may have, or what influences we may have to try to get things moving in a different direction. So I will say that, and with that, those of you who cannot continue to be with us in the webinar, I say good evening to you, and thank you so much for listening to almost this hour of conversation with the wonderful Diane Witchery. But those of you who want to follow, if you can, follow us over, and we will be there and talking for a few minutes, not long, because I think we covered a whole lot of ground right now without me backing Diane into a corner, making her tell me season to season what she wants to accomplish. So I don't want to be that to her. but I thank you all for joining us. Really, thank you so much. And Diane, I'm going to, you know, play us out here with a little of the music that's on the charts here. And I'll see you visually in a few minutes. How about that?
All right.
Thank you.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so very much.
All right.
It has been wonderful. Thank you so very much. And
all right,
everyone, again, I'll see you on the radio. Bye-bye now. Lenny Gottfried Straight, no chasing.
Bye-bye.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, 'cause they don't know how to love you. Far away, you give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night. Bless my soul,